every great company is an overnight success 10 years later, 15 years later. Building great companies is so soul-crushingly hard. And we all got a little tricked in 20 and 21 and 22. I think crypto was a category where you felt like so many people were getting rich so quickly all around you. And there was this like moment of FOMO where you're like, what the hell just happened? Like all these like weird people are crushing. And it like made its way into venture in a way where, and look, the markets were ripping and interest rates were zero. And there was all this stimulus post-COVID. And there was just this moment where it felt like everything worked. I think we've moved from what's on the bottle to what's in the bottle. There was a time where marketers were the founders of choice. And I think you've moved into like people wanting to back scientists and people wanting to back really defensible supply chains that are proprietary. Certainly people who have distribution advantages that feel unfair. It's not just like you're a clever marketer, you have a nice brand aesthetic and a cool way of communicating. That's really, really, really tough to do.
Welcome back. This is a fun one. I think we're at episode 7. So the season's flying by. Today we have Ben Lehrer. If you don't know of Lehrer Hippo, Lehrer Hippo is one of the most incredible venture firms that have backed a ton of fun brands. I worked at a Lehrer Hippo backed brand early in my career, but they've been behind Warby and Casper and then some fun ones like Air, et cetera. Ben is also an accomplished entrepreneur and operator. He was the founder of Thrillist, which was then recently sold, but he's been an operator for a bunch of years. So super excited to talk through all things D2C, all things venture. Ben, thanks for being here.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Cody, do you want to kick it off? Well, before we kick it off, I should say that part of this show is we are very crazy about beverages. So I'm always popping a beverage just to kind of kick things off. Cody's got his water.
I need a beverage.
Yeah. Well, you were just drinking something.
I don't know if anyone will ever see this. I'm holding a beautiful Lehrer Hippo branded glassware, but it's just filled with water. So I don't know what to do. Should I text someone and see if I can get a better beverage?
you probably should. We have like 40.
The office, there's somebody.
we'll save that.
Like 40-ish minutes, so we can swing in a beverage mid-show. But
I'm gonna do this. I'm getting a beverage delivery. I have to. Oh wait, Emily's in the beverage.
Yeah, she's listening on. Eli, you've got three. What do you got? Yeah, we've got something. Some sparkling
Today's
water.
Been a long day.
I'm gonna do a Spindrift. It's not exactly like very exciting, but it's what we got. So we're gonna have to
love it.
Throw a little rum in it, maybe. Get this party.
A little liquid death. All right,
we're here to have some fun. All right, so yeah, let's get in it, Ben. Thanks so much for joining us.
A lemon perfect? Are you holding a lemon perfect, Eli? I'll tell you something.
Lehrer Hippo?
No, it's not, but I will tell you that years ago I met the founder of Lemon Perfect when it was just an idea. And we've traditionally not done a lot of F&B stuff, Yanni. And I met Yanni and I thought he was a total maniac in a good way. And yep. I was sort of like, this is just like not like this. It honestly didn't even feel like he was pitching us, and it was more of just like a get to know you. He was a good friend of a buddy. And I have been it's so fun to see something where you meet somebody at an early stage and you just see it like really work and the business rip for such a nice person. And so every so often I'll write Yanni a note and just be like, dude, I just saw like Lemon Perfect at this like incredible giant national account where you had awesome shelf space and you're clearly crushing it. And I keep writing the same kind of Yanni note every so often, just congratulating him because he's ripping.
Season 3 of Down to Chat is brought to you by TapCart. We've chatted a bunch about TapCart in the past, but they make it extremely easy to create an app that often sees higher conversion, higher AOV, higher LTV from all the folks that use it. I wanted to briefly highlight our friends Ron and Ash from Obvi. You've probably seen them on Twitter. They create a ton of magic with Obvi. Some stats that they've seen with TapCart: 100% higher conversion rate in-app versus mobile web, 95% app user retention, 15%+ higher AOV in-app, and 1.5x transactions on app for everyone on their website. If looking at these stats, their app has an impressive conversion rate on app versus mobile web, higher retention, higher AOV, all of which, you know, increase their LTV and overall revenue. They're so awesome at creating, you know, a community and driving that community towards their app as a tool to turn shoppers into brand advocates. If you've not yet checked out TapCart, check them out today and get up to 2 months free when you sign up. It's tapcart.com/down-to-chat, tapcart.com/down-to-chat. Now let's get into it.
All right. So, Ben, we love to kind of keep the bios short because, you know, if you've been on other podcasts, people can kind of get that anywhere, but probably we'll go a little bit more kind of into like what you're up to now and kind of like things about, you know, DTC and just your thoughts about consumer brand. But let's keep a super short, super quick one, like kind of tell folks a little bit of what you have done and what you're up to now.
Okay. I'll go. It sounds like you've heard me on other podcasts where I just give like a 25-minute introduction.
No, nothing at all about you. I think just in podcasts in general. Yeah.
Okay, short and sweet. After I graduated from college, I moved back to New York where I grew up. I started a digital media company called Thrillist at a time in New York where there was a very small tech scene and very little available venture capital. And raised a little bit of money from sort of non-traditional folks, built the business slow and steady, eventually went out and raised large institutional rounds from all different kinds of folks and built a, you know, startup for 13 or 14 years. And all the while was building Lyra Hippo. And the impetus for starting Lyra Hippo was really based on my experience finding a lack of early stage venture money in New York 13 years ago, which is what inspired us to start the fund. And our first fund was really investing in sort of my friends and peers in New York. And we got lucky with timing that New York continued to grow and become a place where all kinds of really interesting tech got built. And so I've done two jobs for the last 12 or 13 years. Last year, sold the company that Thrillist became a part of called Group 9 to Vox. And have been a full-time VC for a year. Is that good?
That's amazing. That's amazing. Congratulations. Okay. Nice, short and sweet. And also quite the time transition into a full-time venture capitalist.
Well, I think I destroyed the whole world. It would. yeah, it's, sorry about that. I was building the firm and investing for over a decade. And so I got a lot of exposure to sort of the boom times. And by the way, building a company, even in good times, is almost impossible. And so I also got the crap kicked out of me a bunch doing that. And so I have, I'd say, like a decently strong constitution to do torturous things. And now that I've been, you know, here full time for a year and the market has changed a bunch, I think that my timing almost couldn't have been better in that this is a big moment of change for venture. It's a, you know, with moments of change, there's a bunch of tough stuff, but there's also big opportunity. And I think that it's really lucky that I'm here full time for this transitional moment for the industry and for our fund as a result. And, you know, we're trying to run this place more like, I'd say, with sort of some of the principles that we ran Group 9 with in terms of acting more like an operating company, urgency, things that I think a lot of VC has really not been built with over the last few decades. And so, I'm turning this to really go back to the lemon perfect. I'm definitely turning these lemons into lemonade as far as the market is concerned.
Love it.
Well then.
So, like, specifically, you guys are kind of, would you say you're equal parts consumer and SaaS or B2B? Or like, how would you kind of describe what you guys are focused on?
Yeah, I'd say we are generalists. And so we're, most important thing is the founding team. The next most important thing is sort of the right founder market fit, like building in the right market with the right tailwinds and something we believe should exist, not just for sort of like the VC of it all, but actually for like humans. And then, we are big believers in sort of like the power of our network, which over the course of a decade or so is, you know, 400 companies that we've invested in. And so our community is our brand, And so we continue to sort of, ride, like we're passengers on a rapidly changing market. And I think we participate in every sort of big consumer or non-consumer market and shift, but we're not, we started doing almost entirely consumer because at that point, New York was almost entirely consumer. That was the market here. The market has changed. We've got real tech here. We've got people doing all different kinds of things in all different kinds of markets. And we've materially diversified the kinds of stuff that we do over the years. And now we do much, much less consumer because a lot of the sort of arbitrage opportunities and the first to market opportunities and the really disruptive opportunities of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago are not as present today. And there's other places where there's where there's a sort of a better moment to lean in.
Is that, and obviously with that, you know, obviously, you know, very different market the last decade and interest rates were down, but also, you know, DTC was hot and DTC was a new thing. And there were these new super hot companies that obviously were, you know, kind of arbitraging that. And you guys were, you know, were really successful in that. And it sounds like you're not kind of seeing that anymore. I feel like the pendulum has shifted the other side, at least in DTC, which is like DTC is dead. Like you have to be omnichannel. Like what's your current thoughts if you're evaluating company, if you're, you know, thinking about it, like, do you care at all? Do you have to be omnichannel? Is DTC still viable?
Look, I think DTC had a very short window where going direct to consumer was the innovation. That was a short-lived moment where, you know, the story was like cutting out the middleman to the consumer. And maybe there was a moment where there was like, you know, a Facebook arb moment or an Instagram arb moment, or, you know, and maybe now there's like a Facebook Reels moment or a, you know, even the TikTok arb moment is almost over. So, you know, there's always some like mini arb that people are focusing on. I think the thing that was nice about 10 years ago was you had these big, traditional, undisrupted markets with really sleepy, monopolistic incumbents and an opportunity to build brands that communicated differently and marketed differently. Mm-hmm. And that playbook is over. And it's been over for a long time. And I think that what became clear was, you know, sometimes it was that it was a mirage to begin with, that the companies were fueled by venture capital that were just buying users in an unsustainable way. I think that, you know, there was times where that was the case. I think more than that, though, it was just that any business that is that's like a one-trick pony is going to run out of runway at some point. If your whole strategy is to do sort of one thing, if you spend very little money doing that, you can like build something that matters and hopefully flip it at the right time, but you run out of runway. And so what's happened over time is it's gotten clear that to build a consumer business that really serves sort of like this modern, changing, fickle, overstimulated consumer, you need to be good at a lot of things. You need to figure out you need to have a direct strategy. You need to have an omnichannel. You need to have a retail strategy. You need to have a wholesale strategy. You saw like over proliferation of SKUs where companies chased revenue. You saw companies go international too fast and chase revenue. I think there was just generally a habit around chasing revenue that again was fueled by sort of a theory in the market. And now we've gone, the pendulum has swung very hard to the other side where there is there's no frenzy. And in fact, maybe we're nearing a time where there's actually a fun opportunity to go and do some early consumer stuff again, because there's less competition, there's less new brands popping
up. Valuations are down.
And certainly valuations are down.
What's interesting to me, I think Lara in general has gone pretty seed focused. I think it's interesting, you know, given kind of like where brands are in their journey, so much can change. Like there are so many founders that found one business and then that's not viable. And 6 months, 2 years later, they switch. So your focus on like founder market fit and just founding team is so much more interesting because you're focused on like, what is the possibility that can come when these people sit in a room together versus like, how much can I arbitrage this razor? Will that take me to a $1 billion valuation? The other part that's interesting to me as well is I think we've seen this kind of like 2016, 2017, 2018, where there was this CAC to LTV approach where like you'd spend $300 to acquire a customer and the first order AOV was 35, but then like, you know, there was this focus on like 10, 12, 15 orders. Brands have gone public. You know, putting that on their S1, like Hims is a great example of like their CAC to LTV ratio made sense on paper, but their LTV was like 3 years versus 6 months. I'm curious how you think about that now as the pendulum has kind of swung towards profitability. I'm curious how you think about like this CAC to LTV. Is that a real thing? How do you view first order profitability in general?
So I do think you've seen, again, the pendulum swing. You went from like, there was a time where there was no consciousness whatsoever around return on marketing spend. It was just like, go, like spend as much as you can. Your company will trade on a revenue multiple. Go, 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 go. And then it was like, okay, how do you think about LTV and, you know, LTV to CAC ratio? And then you've moved into like absolute positive first purchase profitability. And I think you've even moved beyond that now into how dare you spend any marketing dollars? Like great brands are built totally organically off of community. Like if you ever go and get addicted to that Facebook drug or that Google drug, like it's going to kill you. And I think that there is a truth to that. Obviously there are situations where something is really working and marketing dollars are truly throwing fuel on the fire. But I think like long ago, the VC community and certainly at LH, we sort of shifted our focus around if someone's coming in and saying they're raising a $3 million seed round so they can go spend $2 million on Facebook, you can probably like skip that meeting. Like that's that's not the playbook. And So our thinking, and I think the market's thinking, has moved in a few different ways. One is, I think we've moved from what's on the bottle to what's in the bottle. I'm obviously overgeneralizing, and maybe that applies to CPG more than it does. But like, you know, there was a time where marketers were the founders of choice, and I think you've moved into like people wanting to back scientists and people wanting to back, you know, really defensible supply chains that are proprietary. Certainly people who have distribution advantages that feel unfair. It's not just like you're a clever marketer, you have a nice like brand aesthetic and a cool way of communicating. That's really, really, really tough to do. And I don't think there's a lot of money for that. And so again, you've seen celebrity brands get a lot of attention because of perceived and probably real distribution advantages. I think you've seen like some like really interesting technological innovations in various categories get more attention. Some of that in some, you know, for instance, in like hardware and consumer, where people are building things that have like, you know, sort of protected IP and real technological moats. Less so are you seeing the deals of yesteryear, which were, you know, and by the way, there were some wonderful companies built this way and we did some of them, but effectively a business school deck for an undisrupted market where someone could come in with a lower cost product and sell direct to consumer.
So in that sense, you're seeing probably companies should be raising a little bit less money, and then their acquisition, right? Their marketing should be self-sustaining. They really shouldn't be putting the capital to that, but it might go to building out their supply chain, or it might go to ops, or it might go to R&D. Is that kind of how you're thinking about it now?
You know, I would say broadly, companies are probably raising less because that's what the market is offering them. I don't know that, I think there's also different schools of thought where there's other folks who want to actually have companies raise more and give themselves way more runway to be able to sort of weather whatever, storms inevitably arrive. I just think that companies are going to be asked to show product market fit to be able to raise subsequent rounds of financing beyond whatever that first round looks like. And product market fit is not going to be Facebook acquisition seems to be working. If you squint and believe in an LTV calculation, product market fit has to be, there's a real community. It's like when you see it, when there's a brand that there's a certain kind of momentum around and there's a real reason to exist. And there's a customer who's passionate about it. There are brands that if they went away tomorrow, people care. There's actually not that many brands that's the case for. And so when you find one of them, those are the companies that are going to continue to get financed because there's genuine passionate audience that doesn't just buy them because they happen to be for sale at whatever point of sale, people wander into, but are brands that have a real purpose.
Down to Chat is brought to you by Postscript. In my opinion, Postscript is the SMS platform built for Shopify brands. To be totally transparent, we just switched at Jones Road to Postscript, and it is the best decision we've ever made. We were on a competitor before, and they started tacking on all types of fees. The platform was not being improved at all. It was just getting really expensive, and the service we were getting was just nothing compared to what we've received from Postscript since being with them. The product with Postscript is just hands down the best that I've ever used. To me, it has the best integrations for Shopify stores of all sizes. It's got the best feature set. The segmentation is the easiest and most powerful. The pop-ups are great. But really the thing that I love is I've never experienced such great service from a software provider. The only time I heard from our previous provider was around contract renewal time. But with Postscript, they've gone out of their way above and beyond to make our program uber successful. And it's really evident that they care about us getting as much value out of our program as possible. So in my opinion, with Postscript, you get the best product on the market, you get it at the best price, and you get it with the best service. There's a reason why the fastest growing Shopify brands like Dr. Squatch, Native, Olipop, Feastables, and now Jones Road Beauty are all using Postscript for their SMS program. Sign up for Postscript today to take your SMS program to new heights.
Obviously with going off of a lot of these lessons of the past decade and stuff like that, there are, now probably more brands going the bootstrap route. And there are probably, more people who are saying maybe consumer brands shouldn't be raising money in general, shouldn't be raising kind of venture capital. Obviously, as a venture capitalist and you guys are continuing to do so, like what would be kind of your take and retort on that?
I think most companies shouldn't raise venture money. Venture money is a very specific flavor of money, in multiple ways. One way is venture is specifically looking for large outcomes. The entire business model is predicated on large outcomes, and so raising money for a business that does not have a path to really big outcomes just doesn't make sense because everyone's going to be disappointed. One, two, founders, even in a category with potentially big outcomes, you need a founder who actually has the stomach to go and in most cases sort of pass up opportunities to exit the business earlier in what could be life-changing outcomes for them in order to create life-changing outcomes for everybody. It's a sort of and obviously even better outcomes for themselves, but there is a flavor of person who should raise venture capital. And I would say, on top of that, very importantly, the second you raise venture money, it's not your company anymore. And that doesn't mean you don't control the board, but like you have obligations now. There's this like idea that you sort of like throw a party when you raise a round of financing. And there are elements of it's a great accomplishment. It's hard to do. I celebrated when I raised rounds of capital, but responsibility comes with that and stress comes with that. And, I just think that, if you're raising, you have to know what you're getting yourself into. And I think, there are funds who probably do a better job communicating that and sort of helping you understand like the nature of the two-way street going forward versus you know, people who are like, you know, praise the entrepreneur, and then when times are tough, like push them down the stairs. And so there is definitely a, like, most companies shouldn't be venture backed companies. And then in D2C, most companies probably shouldn't be venture backed companies. There are certainly still plenty that should be, and there have been great venture outcomes for consumer businesses. We've had plenty of them, as have many of our peers. And so I refuse to sort of think that, like, the age of something that is being sold to a consumer being funded by VC is or should be over. But everybody just needs to make sure that they have the same intentions.
I love that answer. I thought that was an excellent answer. I love it because it was super refreshing to hear kind of some of the, you know, maybe potential pitfalls or challenges, and not just saying yes, everybody should be raising capital or no, but yeah, totally love that. Is that something, like, you guys are pretty transparent when you're talking to founders and looking into a company? Do you ever turn people away and say, hey, this might not be a VC company?
All the time, we say this is I think you're going to make a lot of. I say this weekly to people. I think you're going to make a lot of money, but I don't think that you should raise venture money, or at least you should raise venture money from us, because I think that this is probably a business that sort of looks like this. And if it works well, and I think it will work well because you're great and this idea is really good and you've got good momentum, but, like, you know, I don't know how this is an outcome that's going to make this relationship really productive for everybody. I think a lot of, that is not unique to me. I think a lot of folks in my seat deliver that kind of message to people. But, you know, I would say that where maybe we can, we at least would like to think that we're different than, or, you know, one of our strengths relative to sort of other folks is trying to be more, I don't know, transparent, empathetic, like, just like a little realer with founders. And that is just a natural product of having started stuff. Like, you know, I've been through that ringer, and I've had some really amazing, wonderful, you know, productive relationships with investors. I've had some that are, you know, not awesome. And sometimes that, by the way, is on me, in the way that I communicated. And I think that there's an instinct with founders, particularly first-time founders, where good news travels fast and bad news travels much, much less fast. And then sometimes that has to do with just, like, a misalignment with our investor and what they're hoping for or looking for. You know, a lot of the time I think investors, like, don't necessarily know what they invested in. And I don't mean that they don't, like, you know, they don't do the work. I just mean that, like, these companies can be complex things, and these are, like, human relationships, and an investor can have a dream and a vision for what a thing is and imagine what a company is going to be. And they often put themselves in the seat of, oh, if I was running this company, it would look like this and it would be this. And sort of, like, you know, will the company to be a thing. And the reality is that, like, that's not what the thing is, and it's not going to be that, and it was never going to be that. And you can get sideways with your investor because the company is, because you're like, you're not what the person signed up for, even though you didn't present yourself as what the person signed up for.
I love that. So, kind of speaking of that, kind of some of the challenges that, you know, brands are having, companies are having right now, like, what has been your advice to founders who are maybe going through a tough time and growth is harder to come by? Or, you know, just hypothetically, like, what would it be if, you know, you had a company and maybe a first-time founder who was, you know, expecting it to be great like it was the last few years, and it's obviously a tougher year for most people right now?
Yeah, I would say every situation is different, so I don't want to overgeneralize, but there's a few things that we talk about. One is, we all, like, every great company is an overnight success 10 years later, 15 years later, whatever it is. Like, these things are hard. Like, building great companies is so soul-crushingly hard. And we all got, like, a little tricked in 20 and 21 and 22. And I think it wasn't like crypto, because, like, so it was the whole market. But I think crypto was a category where there was, like, so many people, you felt like so many people were getting rich so quickly all around you. And there was this like moment of FOMO where you're like, what the hell just happened? Like all these like weird people just like are crushing. And it like made its way into venture in a way where, and look, the markets were ripping and interest rates were zero. And there was all this stimulus post COVID. And there was just this moment where it was like it felt like everything worked. And
yeah.
And we got into a mentality as an industry where like seed to A to B to C was like an 18-month thing. And it was not that rare for companies to go from not existing to being worth $1 billion in 12 months, 18 months, 24 months. And we just got like sideways around how hard this is, how long it takes to build something really special with real lasting value that matters. And so one thing I'll do is just remind people that like, and it stinks if you started your company in 21 and raised a hot round out of the gate on an idea, and now you have to sort of face the realities of like making this a thing that you have to build the right way and the hard way. But that was always a trick. And so the idea is like, you're not a victim. Like this isn't like a terrible luck, unlucky market to build in. This is the way the world is. This is like good things are hard to come by, and this is going to be a slog, and we'll be your partner to help do it. I don't want to pretend that like we're going to actually matter. Like, you know, our companies are going to be successful because the founders and the operators are awesome. Like that's it. Like we will add value. I think we have a really great, you know, method and sort of model for like how we contribute. But at the end of the day, like let's call a spade, a company is going to be successful because of the people that work there. That is, I believe that in my bones. And so one is just to sort of like make them not feel so sorry for themselves around the timing and the situation, and to express our patience and the fact that like we're okay that this is going to take more time. I think that's one piece. I think another is preaching focus and, you know, early companies and even not so early companies can only do a few things well in life. And companies that are trying to boil the ocean and solve 10 problems at once and, you know, fight a battle on every front are going to get themselves into trouble. When I go back, I think a lot about my experience with Casper. We seeded Casper, and I was around that business all the way through going public and then taking it back private. And it was an incredible experience. And one of the big learnings from it was we got so obsessed with growth at all costs and so obsessed with like leaving no room for competitors in a market that was highly competitive that we went international. We expanded SKUs really rapidly. We built a large retail fleet. We did a big wholesale rollout. We moved out of mattresses and into all different types of things around the bedroom and even hardware. We wanted to win the war on social marketing and on TV marketing and on affiliate marketing. We wanted to have higher end product. We wanted to have lower end product. And when you go back and you remember why we started the company, because I went to a mattress store, not me. I mean, you know, Philip McNeil and the team there had this experience, but I intuitively understood it, which was you went to a mattress store and you didn't know what to buy. It was impossible. There's some creepy salesperson and a bunch of weird, different, you're lying down in like gross beds in a store. And like, there's all these different price points and you have no idea what the hell to buy. And Casper started with this beautiful, simple idea, which was, not that every single person who needs a mattress is going to be a customer, but there's a pretty solid percentage of the population who will buy a really solid, good, affordable mattress that comes to your house with a good return policy, and we could build a really big business. And we just got distracted. and we did too many things. And Casper is an example that I've seen executed 100 times. And it's been executed 10,000 times, which is you want to do too many things. And so this is the longest answer I've ever had for a very simple question, which is the other piece of advice is just like pick the thing that you're going to win at that's really important to solving a real problem and just obsessively, maniacally focus on that and close out every other door right now and just put your head down. And that is hard to do, but I think it's good advice.
It was a great answer. I think the proportion of the value to the length totally paid off. I think it was totally worthwhile, and it was a really good answer.
You know what's Ben on the crypto piece?
I'm going to get a call from Philip Grimm, very grumpy about this. All my Casper musings.
Wait, Ben, on the crypto piece, I'd love to hear you talk about AI. What your thoughts? Because we Cody and I are venture capitalists, and we get pitched probably 15 times a week on the hottest AI chat GPT solution that we should layer on top of everything we do. So I'm curious, A, your thoughts, B, how you're navigating the tens of thousands of kind of like layered solutions on top of OpenAI and where you think it'll go.
Yep. I would say, I think sort of we as venture capitalists are really fortunate to have AI right now as like a truly transformational thing to like hang our hat on for where there's going to be a lot of exciting things happening, even in a unexciting market broadly. And so, I think as a result, you see the whole venture community just latching on with both hands and feet and teeth and whatever they've got to sort of this thing that is, that signifies a faster path out of a challenging market. But the power of the sort of innovation that is going to come as a result of where we're at with AI is real. I think everybody, and I don't know that everybody believes that, but that we're certainly convinced of that. It's really, really, really early. I think that there's going to be an extraordinary amount of value and influence at the sort of foundational LLM model level where you have, you'll have the tech superpowers and OpenAI and, maybe Anthropic, who knows, and I'm sure one or two others, but where the costs to operate are extraordinary and most of the world's just not going to be able to play because it's just going to be too expensive. And you're going to, I think that's where a huge amount of the value is going to accrue. And so I think big tech gets stronger. And then there's, like every other market, sort of these layers built in the pyramid on top of it. We're not spending time at the bottom of the pyramid because that's not a seed or early investor market. We're spending a lot of time, as you might imagine, in every other area of the pyramid. And I just think right now, the volume of companies that are getting started and the amount of capital that's going in clearly is going to end up being messy. There's just like it's like, come on. Like we've all seen this movie. This is getting overfunded quickly right now. And you see some of the bad behaviors of 21 rearing their head faster than you would possibly have ever imagined would be the case considering the market correction. And you see, 5-on-50 rounds getting done with like obviously really credible, really smart, experienced people, but we're spending a lot of time around it. I would say we're really interested in a few different things. One is we're looking at our existing portfolio companies and thinking about what they've built, how they've innovated in whatever market they're in, and how their product set might be disrupted or added to or augmented with AI. So not only looking forward at what new fresh team has an AI idea today to go and disrupt insurance, but like, let's look at the insure tech companies in our portfolio that actually have customers and actually have scale and are doing stuff that are not the, super sleepy, slow moving, you know, public incumbent that like maybe isn't going to be able to innovate there. But like, we still have companies that can be really innovative and fast moving and deploy technology at the cutting edge that are not just the new company that we write a check into today. And so one thing we're doing is working retrospectively and working with companies in the portfolio. Two is, I think we're trying to, when we're spending time with new companies, we're just trying to make sure that they're not, I think there's a lot of like really cool demos that are really flimsy in terms of defensibility, in terms of being built on somebody else's model in a not particularly, just like it's a lot of bluster. And so we're trying to make sure that when we're looking at things in the space, that it's folks who we think are going to build the right way and build something that has, again, sort of like a moat around it and is not just like flavor of the month. That, by the way, in many cases is just going to get, that surface area is going to get swallowed up by the big LLMs. Like if it's a lightweight consumer layer, a lot of that stuff is probably going to live natively in these models, or Google's going to do it, or whoever's going to do it, in ways that maybe you don't need 10 or 15 venture-backed companies competing with, you know, PowerPoint in terms of how you're going to make presentations that are, you know, AI enabled or whatever. It doesn't mean that there won't be some winners in these categories, but boy, are there going to be a lot of losers, and people are going to pay dearly to get into a lot of these losers. And so we're going to be in this space. We're going to participate. We did the same. We've done the same in you know, other hype cycles. I think that this is a hype cycle, but it's also just like wonderfully powerful and exciting technology. And it's also got a lot of baggage here in terms of what this, you know, the problems that this can cause and the jobs that this can destroy. And we just got to be, I don't know. This is a moment, and this is not only around AI. This is a moment for every venture capitalist. You got to be on your game really in a serious way. This is not a time to just be like flipping checks around, trying to stay busy. This is a really, really, really serious moment of extraordinary focus for the team here. And I think like all the VCs that I respect feel the same way.
I love that. I think that's another great answer. I think, you know, I was kind of curious about that because there definitely are a lot of similarities between this and the, you know, Web3 crypto hype cycle. And everyone was saying that was going to be the biggest game changer since the iPhone and since mobile. And a lot of people are saying that now about AI, but I think at least the feeling is that there's a lot more actual value and, you know, user value out of it. But it's just hard to not ignore the similarities between both cycles.
Well, what I would say though is what's interesting is there probably will be a lot of similarities in the way that you have sort of summers and winters, where there was a bunch of madness in crypto. Coming back to like the foundational blockchain and what it represents and how it could be, and I think still will be, deployed with real world assets and with identity and in like really, really important, powerful ways. But that like a lot of the stuff that was just getting built was like these super flimsy consumer applications sitting on top of it. We still believe in the long-term viability of blockchain and like the picks and shovels layer, and think that there'll be real consumer applications built on it. I think you'll see, again, I don't want to compare the two because I think that sort of like AI versus, I don't think that they're identical in terms of their like significance to humanity, but, or even close. But I do think that you're going to see a ton over finance. I mean, like, come on, we know, like, this is, you're going to see it get overfunded. You're going to see a lot of hype. You're going to see a lot of big stuff, a lot of markups, a lot of excitement. You're going to see a bunch of stuff get killed. you're going to see a period where people say, we went too early, whatever. And at the foundation, there's real, substantial value. And, how do you ignore the seasons? And how do you think about what is inevitable long, long term? And then make sure that you're, just from a seasonality perspective, not doing anything too egregious, I guess. Like that's the key. We talk a lot about inevitability in our partner meetings. Like, is this for sure going to happen? If so, let's talk about the timing. Let's talk about the price. Let's talk about the team. But let's make sure that we have a pretty strong constitution that this is what the future looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I love that. That makes sense. Yeah, it's clearly there's something here. Clearly there's a lot to be excited about and super game changing. But yeah, I feel like a lot of people will talk about it very similar to crypto, where it's like, you could do this, and eventually in the future this will happen, and this will get replaced, and all of these jobs. And like, it's so easy to be very creative with all of the things that it can do in the future, but then I'll kind of go and play around with what's currently out there, and it's very cool, don't get me wrong, but it's not at a point where it's going to replace any of these jobs or do it kind of quite yet, from at least what I've seen. And I'm kind of looking through the lens of like marketing and replacing a marketer or just making our jobs easier. And like, I haven't seen that yet, but everyone who I at least trust and is speaking about it is like, this thing is moving so fast that like it's only a matter of time.
Yeah. I do think in terms of some of the day-to-day tasks of a marketing team, a content team, a team of developers, I think those are the places that you're going to see really quick. Like if you're leaned in early, like you're going to find real efficiencies there. We have a company in our portfolio, and it'll remain to be seen like exactly how this plays out, but it's a really smart founder who is really trying to operate a business with a third of the people that he traditionally had. Mm-hmm. Partially because the market's crappy and he wants to burn less, but partially because I think he fundamentally believes that if every designer on his team considers Midjourney to be not like a cool sideshow, but like a requirement in how they do their job, and every whatever sort of like piece of tech or endpoint solution they have for different tasks in the business, like everybody needs to be using Copilot on the dev team, whatever it is, like his belief is that he's going to build an organization that does way more with way less. And I'm going to keep a really close eye on that one to see what's real and what isn't.
Interesting. I think it's like to me, it's so fascinating, because I think it's like with every kind of new evolution, you always have, in my universe of customer experience and retention, I'm always looking at like the brands that are like, 100% of my tickets are now being responded to by a bot. And I'm like, I think there's going to be somewhere in middle. I think we're slowly going to kind of swing in the pendulum back and forth and eventually end up somewhere in the middle where people are like, okay, we can increase a ton of efficiency. And now the value of the leader or the three-person team is that they can take the monotonous kind of mundane everyday tasks, toss that to ChatGPT, and then have like a team that's just creating moments or just kind of like breaking the script and doing what hospitality does quite well. But I think in this hype cycle, we're seeing like everyone either be on one extreme or not touching it at all, and kind of like the people in the middle are not sure which way to swing. But it's kind of like NFTs and crypto in that way, where people were either like, this is the worst, don't go near it, or like, I have 100 apes. There's not a lot of like, people aren't just like staying somewhere in the middle. So I think it's interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, it represents a whole lot of hope. And people need that.
Yeah.
Definitely right now. Well, all right. We're almost coming up on 4, and I have a hard stop. I don't know about you guys, but I think this is a great place to end it. But Ben, it's been awesome. It was great to meet and chat and learn from you. And thank for every founder out there, whether it's DTC or SaaS. I know both are listening to this podcast.
Thank you, guys.
Definitely some good stuff to take from.
No.
Thank you, man.
Well, thank you guys so much. Really, I love doing this, and this was a lot of fun. I'm and obviously a huge fan of Jones Road and what you guys are doing. And we actually are fortunate enough to sometimes get to throw Bobby a company to help us make sense of in the D2C world. And she's brilliant and very opinionated, which I appreciate.
Amazing.
Awesome. Well, cool. All right. Thanks so much. Thanks, Ben.
We will talk to you soon.
Okay. Thank you, guys. We'll talk really soon.